From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Politicians in the U.S. like to say they are devoted to the Constitution of this nation. Grassroots activists often speak in terms of protecting people's constitutional rights. The U.S. Constitution is considered a sacred text, cited as a reason to distinguish this nation's superiority over other nations as a mark of progress in exercising democracy and equality. But how robust is this much-revered document? Especially when we have a president who was elected despite losing the popular vote, a Congress that can barely pass any legislation, a party in power that appears hell-bent on kicking out immigrants, locking up people of color, and denying far too many people their basic right to vote. It turns out that many of the reasons that government doesn't work as well as it should today can be traced back to flaws in the Constitution, or as my guest puts it, fault lines. Sanford Levinson is a professor in the Law School and Department of Government at the University of Texas and a frequent visiting scholar at the Harvard Law School. His earlier books include An Argument Open to All, Reading the Federalist in the 21st Century, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. He is the co-author with Cynthia Levison of the new book, Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Welcome to the program, Sandy. So let's begin with the idea that the Constitution is a document that so many people sort of have relied on. We think about it as being this, you know, this thing that sets the U.S. apart from other nations, upholding democracy. But when the founders were actually putting this document together, what guidance did they have to go on? What was it that led them to putting this document together piece by piece?
Well, there are really two questions there. What led them to put it together was the realization in the late 18th century of the importance of written constitutions. The United Kingdom is famous even to this day for not having a canonical written constitution that you can look up on Google. And there are a variety of reasons for that, which aren't worth really going into now. But by the late 18th century, particularly in the United States, written constitutionalism had become pervasive. Basically, almost every state after 1776 wrote down its constitution. And then that gets to the second question you're asking, that is, what sort of guides did they have? They didn't have any guides from any other countries in the world, because the United States really was the first country to embark on a written constitution. But there were other written constitutions within the United States itself. And so to some extent, what they were thinking of, both to accept and to reject, were other models. For example, and very, very importantly, Pennsylvania, which is one of the largest states in the country, had written a constitution in 1776 that adopted a one-house legislature. This was also true of Georgia, but Georgia was obviously much farther away and not very important. The convention made a decision to go have a two-house legislature. And there are a number of ways. One of the things that's important about our book, incidentally, is that we compare the U.S. Constitution not only with constitutions from abroad, but in many ways, and more interestingly, with constitutions of the United States. There are 51 constitutions in the United States, not only the U.S. Constitution. So in 1787, they had a very limited sample of other written constitutions to look at. In 2017, we have a much, much larger set of constitutions to look at, both abroad and within the United States. One of the mantras of James Madison and other of the founders was the importance of learning the lessons of experience. In 1787, frankly, there wasn't that much experience to learn lessons from.
Right.
In 2017, we have 230 years of additional experience. And the view that we take in our book, and I've taken in books written for adult audiences, this book is written for a teenage audience, is that we should learn from our experiences over these years that there really are significant defects and problems.
So let's talk about the fact that there are two houses of Congress. Bicameralism is the formal term for it. And it's been done differently in different states. And so today we have the US Senate, we have the US House of Representatives with different rules for the term limits, representation, et cetera. How has that been a fault line in the Constitution, first of all? And then maybe you can even trace back what the founders were thinking when they set it up this way.
Well, if you look at the 50 states in the United States today, 49 of which are bicameral, only Nebraska is unicameral.
I see.
Each of the two houses, this is true in California, where you're talking to me from. It's true for your listeners in any of the other 49 states other than Nebraska. The House and the Senate of each state are both relatively proportional with regard to the representation. If you look at the U.S. Senate, though, it's spectacularly different because, to take the most obvious example, Wyoming, with about 550,000 people, which is what, about one-sixth the population of LA, has the same voting power in the U.S. Senate as California, with 38 million people. There is no defense of this under any plausible 21st century of democratic theory. And in fact, if you actually look at James Madison in particular in 1787, he hated the decision to give each state equal voting power in the Senate. He described it in one of the Federalist Papers as a lesser evil. The greater evil would have been no constitution at all, and the small states would have walked out and we'd have had no constitution. But an evil is still an evil. And the consequences of the evil of the Senate just get greater and greater, in part because of where Americans choose to live. We have a graphic in the book showing that a little bit less than half the population live in 41 of the 50 states. Half of the population now lives in 9 of the states.
Wow, so there's a real concentration in some states, but each of those states still only gets 2 senators.
Right. So this means that the less than half of the population that lives in 41 of the states, they get 82 votes in the Senate. The majority of the population that live in 9 states, and 1/12 of the entire population lives in California, they get 18% of the power. This has real consequences going beyond simply the violation of what political theorists might view as the requirements of one person, one vote, and the meaning of democracy. If you want to understand why it is next to impossible to pass any legislation restricting guns, the answer is the U.S. Senate, because it so overweights the power of rural states. And I don't want to knock the fact that a lot of people living in rural states believe that it's important to have guns for hunting or for other purposes, but the fact is there are demonstrable differences between the views of firearms of people who live in California and people who live in Wyoming or Vermont. And what you discover, and let me talk about Vermont just for a second. I mean, Vermont is represented by two of the most liberal senators in the country, Bernie Sanders and Patrick Leahy, but they vote more or less the NRA line.
Right.
Because Vermont is a small state, rural state, 650,000 people, and the two senators from Vermont simply cancel out the two senators from California. We talk in our book about agricultural policy and why it is that there is an obesity scourge, particularly among youngsters. And we point out that that's in part because of the huge use of corn syrup in lots of foods. And this can be traced back to agricultural policy that subsidizes quite heavily the growth of corn. And you discover that corn is produced by and large in the states of the upper Midwest plus Illinois, and they have far more power in the Senate than they do in the House. And this is not a liberal, conservative, Democratic, Republican sort of issue. Democratic senators from South Dakota or Iowa are as assiduous in fighting for corn subsidies. It's become a joke every 4 years when presidential candidates go to Iowa and pander about ethanol. And this is because of the structure of the government that was created in 1787, quite unhappily from James Madison's perspective, but it was a deal that had to be made, just as you had to make a deal with slave owners. And these deals really continue to choke us in very, very important ways in 2017.
So there's the issue of the overrepresentation of sparsely populated states in our government. What about just the ability of Congress to pass any legislation at all? I mean, I suppose one might argue no legislation is better than bad legislation, but the U.S. Congress has a terrible reputation with the public because we see how dysfunctional it is, especially with the version of the Republican Party today that overuses its filibuster. And we see, and you point out in your book, that there's less and less legislation actually emerging out of the Congress. Going into it, there's plenty, there's hundreds of bills, but actually bills that become laws, there's very few.
Right. Yeah, this is a very, very important question. And the explanations might differ depending on particular elections. So, for example, as we had for periods of time over the last 10 or 15 years, if one party controls the House and the other party controls the Senate, then it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to get any agreement on the part of both the House and the Senate, particularly given that we become so polarized. But what if one party controls both the House and the Senate? Is that a guarantee of getting legislation through? The answer is no, because of the presidential veto.
Right, that's another problem.
Right, because what we argue is that in a very profound sense, we have a tricameral system in the United States, that it's not enough to run the impressive hurdles that are set up by the Constitution to getting anything through both the House and the Senate. It's also the case that a single individual called the President of the United States, who may or may not represent a majority of the country, certainly Donald Trump doesn't, can nonetheless, by refusing to sign legislation, basically scrap it unless both houses of Congress vote by two-thirds to override the presidential veto. But you're also pointing to the extraordinarily important fact that even if one party controls the House, the Senate, and the presidency, we are discovering, either to our dismay or our happiness, depending on where you are in the political spectrum, that they still can't govern effectively. And at this point, I think you have to talk about the breakdown of the Republican Party and the polarization within the Republican Party itself, as well as the different polarization between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
Now, isn't that a separate issue from the way from the issue of the Constitution and what's
that? One has to be careful in the analysis, and your question is entirely to the point. What we focus on, from our title to every chapter in the book, is the extent to which the Constitution itself helps to explain certain issues or problems. So, you know, I've tried to show why the Constitution itself explains why we have the often perverse agricultural policies we have, and that it really doesn't matter to some extent whether Democrats or Republicans are in control because of the excessive weight of the upper Midwestern states. But with regard to other issues, one certainly has to look at American political culture, at the polarization among Americans and the like. And at that point, you might, you know, shrug your shoulders and say, you know, there's no constitutional system that can guarantee a well-functioning government if you have certain degrees of polarization. So, I mean, this is a deep problem with regard, say, to designing constitutions in foreign countries. Could any constitution overcome the strains in Iraq or Afghanistan? You can march through, or in Spain right now.
Right.
You can march through a lot of examples. And this is something we really always ought to realize, that no constitution is perfect, no constitution can do everything. But what we argue is that that our constitution, our national constitution, is notably imperfect in a number of ways and could be better.
Now, when we look at the whole idea, of course, of a democracy and a constitution that governs a democracy is to be able to have elected representatives that by and large enable the government to do what a majority of people might want, while, of course, protecting minorities. So we see on issue after issue today, there's the issue of gun control, as you pointed out. There's the issue of health care. You know, majorities of Americans may want something. The issue of immigration, a majority of Americans do want something humane for immigrants. And you point out in your book that these were flaws that were apparent very close to the beginning of this country with the issue of the anti-lynching laws. And I thought this was a fascinating story. And I didn't realize that at the time when lynchings were at their height, there was actually a deep and pretty widespread desire among Americans for anti-lynching laws to be passed and to hold those, you know, lynch mobs and people involved in them accountable. But because of the flaws in our Constitution, it just took far too long for that to be put into place.
Right. I think it might even be the opening story. And one of the things that the way the book is structured is that each chapter begins with a story, all but one of them being entirely true, with, you know, footnotes and citations. And so the first story we tell, as you point out, has to do with attempts to make lynching a federal crime. A Republican member of Congress from St. Louis, backed by the Republican president Warren Harding, who usually doesn't get any credit at all for anything, but Harding was in fact better on the issue of race than Woodrow Wilson was. Wilson was an out-and-out racist, which can't be said of Harding. They supported anti-lynching law, and It died in the Senate because of the power of white Southern Democrats to filibuster. And we mention other episodes where anti-lynching laws actually got through the House and died in the Senate because of the filibuster. And, you know, I think the fact is, and this is a theme of the book, that the designers of the Constitution were not necessarily huge fans of little d democracy.
Right, I mean, which is a surprise.
Right, and so they put into the Constitution all sorts of veto points in order to prevent the majority from ruling. You made a very, very important point a moment ago in your question. Do we fear bad legislation more than we look forward to the prospects of good legislation? No constitutional system will guarantee that only good legislation will pass. So you always have to, you know, basically make a judgment call. Are you willing to run the risk that some legislation you really don't like will get through, but that other times legislation you do like and is supported by a majority of your fellow Americans will get through? And from my perspective, we, or at least the framers, were so scared of bad legislation, they made it extraordinarily difficult to pass good legislation. And I think this is one of the reasons why, if you look at polling data, you discover that a majority of the country believes the country is going in the wrong direction. A majority of the country, a very large majority of the country, has only contempt for Congress, because wherever you are on the political spectrum, left, right, and center, it really doesn't matter. You can't look at the contemporary national government and believe that it is going to respond effectively to whatever you happen to believe is the major set of issues facing the country. And Sandy, that's very corrosive.
I want to talk about the issue of voting now, because that's so important. How we elect our representatives is also very, very crucial. And maybe that is more relevant to this idea of the political culture. You know, in the election of 2016, for only what, the third or fourth time, did we have a president who lost the popular vote and won the election because of this electoral college system. And every 4 years, Americans just sort of shake their heads going, how did this, why is there an electoral college? How did this happen? Who decided this was a good idea? And this is, of course, an extremely important part of your book. Let's talk about where the Electoral College came from. Is this also the framers fearing truly participatory democracy and really not wanting to give like one person, one vote in to people?
The answer is yes and no. One of the things that we don't do in our book is engage in what I call founder bashing. Because I'm willing to say that they were faced with certain political, what they called exigencies in 1787 that they had to respond to. And they did overall what they thought was the best they could. And I'm really quite willing to honor most of the framers for doing the best they could. But let's look at the Electoral College very specifically. Why did they choose the Electoral College? Part of the reason is that they couldn't figure out a better way to elect the president. There were, some people said, well, the president should elect Congress should elect the president. And then some people said, well, no, that's a bad idea because that would make the president too much simply a servant of Congress. A few people said, well, let the people at large select the president. But the response in 1787 to that is, look, We're actually a big country geographically, ranging from, you know, Maine, which was then northern Massachusetts, to the southern border of Georgia, over to the east bank of the Mississippi River, obviously not remotely so large as we are today, but that's still quite large. And so what they said, altogether sensibly, is that ordinary people in Massachusetts were not really likely to know who the most attractive leaders might be emerging even from New York, let alone Virginia or South Carolina. Ditto with regard to people living in, you know, North Carolina or Georgia. They don't really know who the really impressive people from Massachusetts or Connecticut might be. So the art, and you didn't have national newspapers, quite obviously. I mean, it's almost absurd to point out that we didn't have Skype. We didn't have modern mass communications. So the argument was that it would make sense for the people to vote basically for local notables, people they thought they could trust to make judgments about who were the attractive leaders elsewhere, because one of the things that made one a local notable is that they were more cosmopolitan. They were more likely to have traveled to Philadelphia or traveled to New York or have business interests perhaps in South Carolina. So this made good sense in 1787. It makes no sense whatsoever in 2017. And so then the question is, well, why are we still stuck with this institution that a majority of Americans in every poll taken since 1944
by
the organization, a majority say, basically, get rid of the Electoral College. Well, why do you still have the Electoral College? The answer is a combination of the Senate and the fact that power is not allocated equally in the Senate, not equally by population, but also the sheer difficulty of constitutional amendment. We have the most difficult to amend constitution of any country in the world.
And yet, and right after the Constitution, we did have a Bill of Rights. But
that was in part of the original deal, that there were people who didn't like the Constitution, but who said, okay, we'll ratify the Constitution if you promise to add a Bill of Rights. So the first 10 amendments were added relatively uncontroversially, and in some real sense, they're part of the original set of negotiations and compromises. But then you don't have truly significant fundamental changes until the late 1860s as the result of a war that killed 750,000 people. And then you don't have changes for about another 50 years that took place during the Progressive Era, 100 years ago, which is a time of real discussion about the Constitution's adequacy. We live in a world where most people have never experienced a significant constitutional amendment. The last one of true significance was the 22nd Amendment in 1951 that established the two-term limit for
presidents. President, right.
There have been other amendments since then, but let me tell you, as somebody who teaches constitutional law for a living, most academics or lawyers, let alone most Americans, could not identify the 24th Amendment if their life depended on it. And there is just a feeling of futility on the part of many, many people today with regard to suggesting constitutional amendment because Article 5 makes it so difficult. And here again is where it's really, really interesting to look at American states, because for better and for worse, you can argue either way. You're talking to me from California. The California Constitution makes it possible for we, the people of California, to amend the Constitution through direct democracy, the initiative referendum. There have been some good amendments, there have been some bad amendments. But one thing Californians can do, if they're angry about what they see happening in California government, is say, let's do something about it. Let's change the Constitution, or let's, you know, pass statutes through initiative referendum. We can't do that at the national
level. At the federal level, right. The other thing that I do want to get to, Sandy, which I think is also so important, especially these days, is that the Constitution does, the U.S. federal Constitution does not specify very much detail about something we feel is so basic in our electoral system, and that's simply voting. The federal government leaves it to the states. The Constitution leaves it to the states to figure out the details of rules for voting, which today, of course, the Republican Party has deeply exploited, realizing that they can impact elections across the country simply by making it harder for those people who might tend to be Democratic to vote. Is that not a deep flaw in our Constitution?
Yes. It is, you know, it might have made sense. Again, it certainly made political sense in 1787 to leave it to each state, because in 1787, for example, women could vote in New Jersey, or at least some women could vote in New Jersey. Not surprisingly, other states found this unthinkable. There were a number of states that allowed free blacks to vote. Again, quite obviously, some of the slave states would have found that unthinkable. So it wasn't in the cards in 1787 to have a single national answer to the question of who can vote. It's not clear in the 21st century that we should leave it up to the states to decide who can vote. We would like to think we're a much more national country than we were in 1787. But let me point to one other grievous flaw in the Constitution along these lines. That is, it's not simply that states have a wide discretion to decide who can vote, but they also get to run elections.
Right.
So you talk about voter suppression, and voter suppression can take place in a number of different ways. One example is to exclude felons from voting, and that's very, very important in a number of states. Another way is to say, well, we'll allow you to vote, but you have to show a photograph, you have to show ID. And that's a way of keeping the vote down. You can also say, we're going to limit the number of precincts, so you're going to have to travel inconveniently if you want to vote. Or we're going to cut down what has come to be called early voting. In Texas, for example, where my wife and I spend a bit more than half of our time, one can vote 2 or 3 weeks before the election. That's become true in a lot of states. One of the things that Republicans in North Carolina, for example, and it is important that they're Republicans, this is not simply a bipartisan good government response to the critique of a friend of mine, for example, that there really are problems with early voting because you never know what might happen 2 or 3 days before an election that might change your vote. And, you know, that's not a dumb argument. But the reason the North Carolina legislature, dominated by Republicans, limited early voting is because they correctly believe that early voting advantages particularly African-American Democrats. And they want to suppress the vote. And this is a terrible
Right. Feature. And we used to have a thing called the poll tax in some parts of the country as well, right? Which in many ways, you might see these obstacles to voting as a different form of a poll tax these days.
Exactly right. That if you require voter ID, and if, as in North Carolina, you won't allow ID issued by a college you happen to go to, instead, it has to be some official state card. Well, it might cost money to get that. Even if the card is, quote, free, unquote, you might have to take an expensive bus or give up a day of work to go to the one or two places in the county that might give you the card. But then they might say, well, look, you know, you shouldn't expect free lunch. We're going to charge you $5 or $10 for this voter ID. And that does function as the equivalent of a poll tax. The 24th Amendment that I mentioned a few minutes ago did, in fact, outlaw the poll tax. But there are lots of ways by which states can in effect impose costs on people who would like to vote. And what we've seen, particularly over the last 10 years or so, is attempts almost entirely by Republican state legislatures to make it harder and harder for those they view as their political opponents to vote.
Finally, Sandy, let's talk about, I mean, there's so many issues, so many fault lines that you describe in your book, Fault Lines in the Constitution. But let's end our conversation with this idea of, okay, now that we've identified some of these fault lines, what to do about it? And you alluded to it earlier, you know, the fact that our Constitution has not been amended in such a long time to kind of deal with this new reality we live in is an issue. And I know that you and your co-author and wife, Cynthia Levinson, have a sort of written are back and forth at the end of the book about whether or not to have a constitutional convention. Republicans do want to have a constitutional convention, and there's a great risk in having a constitutional convention, yet to improve the Constitution, that may be the only way. So where do you land on this issue?
Thanks for bringing that up. It's certainly true that the book, which was really substantially written by my wife, who's a very, very talented author of books for younger audiences, is written in a single voice until the very last chapter, where we speak in our own quite different voices about the issue of a new constitutional convention. I support a new convention for a variety of reasons, because I think a serious convention, and I envision a convention that could last as long as a couple of years, that would be covered on C-SPAN and, you know, other forms of public television and public radio, and would generate debates all over the country about many of these issues. I don't think Congress has the time to do that, even if you believe they have the inclination to do it, which I don't think they have either. But Cynthia, like I have to say, most of my friends and family and professional colleagues, all of them are by and large scared to death of the idea of a new constitutional convention. And it isn't made any easier by the fact that the right wing is currently, or certain aspects of the right wing, are currently campaigning for a new constitutional convention. So then there are two possible responses. One is to say the very idea of a constitutional convention is terrible, because you simply imagine the worst case possibilities and say, well, I'm just not willing to run that risk.
So better the devil you know, basically.
Right. And I think that's basically Cynthia's view. Mm. My response to that is that opponents of the right-wing convention should say, I oppose your specific ideas. The governor of Texas, for example, Greg Abbott, has proposed what he calls the Texas Plan. That would involve 9 important constitutional changes, and he advocates a new constitutional convention. So we had a debate at the law school, a 3-way debate. Somebody from the governor's office defended the Texas Plan. I attacked the Texas Plan, said that it was full of some really terrible ideas, but I was willing to give Governor Abbott 1 cheer for recognizing that we really ought to have a long overdue discussion about the kind of constitution we want the 21st century. The former dean of the University of Texas Law School denounced both of us, said it's just a terrible idea to have a convention at all. And I think, you know, this is the great debate. One of the reasons I am not so fearful of a convention as Cynthia is, and you know, most of my friends and family, is that a convention, in order to be effective, would have to establish its legitimacy among the American public at large. It would be on C-SPAN, it would be covered by public radio. And if it simply turned out to be a rump convention of the far right, it wouldn't establish that kind of legitimacy. In order to amend the Constitution, you need the approval of 3/4 of the states. That's 38 states. So even if you assume that a convention would be able to organize itself and run roughshod over competing points of view and propose what you and I might well regard as some very, very bad ideas, I think we can be fairly confident that there would be 13 states, and that's all it would take, for better and for worse. I mean, I said before that the U.S. Constitution is the most difficult to amend constitution in the world, so that it might be the case that if there were a very good constitutional convention that would be proposing changes that you and I would love to see, it might still be the case that you'd get 13 states to say no. And that, I think, is a real problem. But I'm willing to rely on what I continue to believe is the remaining good sense of the American people, plus the fact that it's so difficult, in fact, to amend the Constitution. Because what I fear, and this is one of the real points of our book, is that we're just in a state of continuing denial about the fault lines of the Constitution, some of which are obvious, like the Electoral College, some of which are not. We have a chapter about the so-called continuity in government problem. Should there be a successful terrorist attack that would, for example, kill or disable 70 members of the Senate, or 300 members of the House, it turns out that the Constitution is terrible with regard to how we would reconstitute a government. And so if we get into the frame of mind, which I think most Americans actually do believe, that the Constitution is either really terrific and we don't need to discuss potential changes at all, or even if it's not terrific, we're so scared that any changes will be for the worse rather than for the better, that we just ought to go along and accept the Constitution we've got and hope for the best. So it's really very, very important for us to have a long overdue conversation about what needs to be strengthened in the Constitution, and then how do we do that?
Right.
Do we do it through legislation? Some could be done through legislation. Do we do it through kind of ordinary constitutional amendment? Some of it could be done. But I continue to believe that ultimately the kind of extensive deliberation and discussion that you would get in a new Constitutional Convention is the way we ultimately have to go.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Sandy. And I know that you and your co-author, Cynthia Levinson, are going to be on a speaking tour, a book tour, which can be found, details of which can be found online at faultlinesintheconstitution.com. So we'll post a link to that from our website later today.
Great.
Good
Great.
Luck to you, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sanford Levinson, a professor in the Law School and Department of Government at the University of Texas and a frequent visiting scholar at the Harvard Law School. We have been discussing the new book that he has co-authored with Cynthia Levinson, Fault Lines in the Constitution, the Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.